Coming up on Tech News Today, Flipboard heads to the web. A Nobel Prize winning economist cries death to software patents, metaphorically. And nobody's buying Ouya games. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 26 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code TNT7. And by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world. Put them in some context for you, starting with the top 10 stories of the day. The News Fuse. Netflix posted some great financial numbers yesterday. Income rose to earnings per share of 49 cents, beating expectations of 40 cents. And sales increased 20% to $1.07 billion, matching expectations. But everybody's talking about subscriber numbers. Netflix matched its own guidance of 630,000 new subscribers, but the street wanted 700,000. So Netflix is now suddenly a disappointment. CEO Reed Hastings said in their video earnings call that Netflix would expand into original documentaries and stand-up comedy shows.
Nokia has launched a bigger Lumia smartphone, the Lumia 625. It comes with a 4.7-inch screen and will cost about 220 euros before taxes and subsidies. Earlier this month, Nokia unveiled a higher-end Lumia 1020 model. That's the one with a 41-megapixel camera. Nokia is looking to gain in market share after falling behind South Korea's Samsung. Everybody seems to fall behind Samsung these days, which has a quarter of the market share, Nokia at 15%.
If you're a fan of Flipboard, you might like this next story. Flipboard just launched a full HTML5 version of its magazines that will work on any browser, desktop or mobile. Right now, Flipboard on the web is a bit limited. You'll have access to Flipboard's curated list of magazines. The company says to expect a full experience that lets you access your subscriptions and search by the end of this year or early 2014.
One long patent nightmare is over. The Aeolus patent suit brought in 2009 against a dozen tech companies alleged infringement of patents around video streaming, search suggestions, and other interactive elements on pages. Tim Berners-Lee even testified against the patent. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in Washington, D.C. upheld a lower court decision that major portions of the interactive web patents were invalid. Over the years, companies like Microsoft, Office Depot, Rent-A-Center, Playboy, and Oracle had all settled with Aeolus.
Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba, remember, they had a really, really good quarter, has announced a smart TV OS and is working with a number of partners, including Cisco and Chinese manufacturers, to develop smart TVs, set-top boxes, and services to run inside them. Alibaba already has a smartphone and tablet OS called Alian, which started as an internal mobile platform, later spun off with an investment. But a spokesperson tells The Next Web that Alian and the smart TV are two different products for two different types of devices. But it is our aim in the future to create enhanced synergy between the two for multi-device and multi-screen usability.
The Syrian Electronic Army is claiming it has stolen 1.5 terabytes of users' personal data from the video and text app Tango. The SEA posted screenshots on its website to prove the hack and says it will turn over much of the information to the Syrian government. Tango confirmed the attack via Twitter, but did not confirm the amount of data stolen or that the SEA is responsible.
You might think Apple forgets about podcasts sometimes, but they don't. In fact, Monday, they announced the iTunes Store has passed 1 billion podcast subscriptions. Apple said the number is spread across 250,000 unique podcasts in more than 100 languages with more than 8 million episodes, some of them not even hosted by Leo Laporte.
eBay Now, the same-day shipping service that started in San Francisco and then expanded to San Jose, California, and New York, is expanding again. The Bay Area Peninsula, Brooklyn, Queens, as well as Chicago and Dallas are all getting eBay Now service by the end of the summer. And the company is launching a PC version of eBay Now for the desktop.
Verizon announced three new Motorola Droid phones this morning. The thin $199 Droid Ultra, a new $299 Droid Max featuring long battery life, and the $99 Droid Mini, which is mini, it's small. All three phones will supposedly have 24% faster CPU, 100% faster GPU, plus two times the RAM of last year's model. The phones also feature touchless control through voice, notifications on lock screen, and quick camera access. Sound familiar, Moto X leakers? All three phones will be available August 20th.
Samsung released full details on the new Exynos 5 Octa system on a chip. The 5420 variant includes four ARM Cortex A15 cores at 1.8 GHz and four 1.3 GHz Cortex A7s. Samsung claims a 20% processing increase and twice the 3D graphic power. It also has a memory bandwidth of 14.9 gigabytes per second, which, among other things, lets it do full HD Wi-Fi display support. No word on what devices will use it, but the chip goes into mass production in August.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Shutterstock.com. Not the randomizer, but Shutterstock.com. Shutterstock.com lets you find the perfect image or video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, a publication, an advertisement, video, any kind of project you can think of. You can find the images you need, good images, at Shutterstock.com. 26 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations. They got vector graphics. They got video clips in there. And they source their images from around the world, so you get a wide variety, professional photographers, professional artists, and Shutterstock reviews each image. They make sure that each one of them is quality, but that doesn't mean they're not constantly adding stuff. They're adding 10,000 images a day. You can choose the image pack that works for you, whether you want a monthly subscription if you're using it all the time, or you can just download an image pack. You can download any image, any size, pay only one price. Shutterstock gives you the images you need to bring your creative projects to the next level. And, and don't get me started on their search tools. They're amazing. You can search by emotion, for goodness sake. You can take all of those images, share them in a light box with other people to make sure you got everybody on the same page. It's a complete global offering, but you don't have to take any of my words for it. Go try Shutterstock out today. Get a free account. You don't even need a credit card. Just start an account. Begin finding those images for your next project, putting them in a light box to review later. And once you decide to purchase, use the offer code, don't forget this, TNT7, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com for 30% off new accounts. Use offer code TNT7. And we thank Shutterstock for their support of Tech News Today. Joining us now to discuss the stories of the day, very happy to have Nate Langson, editor of wired.co.uk. Welcome to the show, Nate.
Hello, thank you for having me with my severe technical difficulties.
Well, we understand with the royal baby and all of the press using all the internet, there's just not much left for anyone else.
Yeah, apparently that is sucking up most of the bandwidth, which is a shame because I could think of better ways to put bandwidth, to be honest.
You know, you're the first of three British guests this week, so I'm sure we'll get a sense, a 360-degree view of how people are dealing with that. But we're not here to talk about babies or monarchs or anything like that. We're here to talk about Flipboard, where you can go to read about babies, monarchs, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, you could curate your own magazine about all things British and royal and all of you. I could put it together and you guys could all access it on the web. Flipboard is basically saying we've had a lot of success with regular Flipboard users curating their own magazines. Sometimes it's, you know, some sort of an individual thing. I have one for recipes that I like. Sometimes businesses are putting it together. They say people have made over 2.5 million enthusiast magazines. So a magazine curated by whatever you're interested in. And now the company has decided to launch full HTML5 versions of those magazines. So you can view those in any browser on mobile version, regular web version. If you're looking at my little cookbook, Flipboard magazine, for example, it's sort of the illusion of flipping because, of course, Flipboard started on the iPad. CEO Mike McHugh says they always plan to launch the service on the web. Then once the iPad was rumored to become a thing several years ago, they decided, let's go all in on the tablet, and have had a lot of success there. But you sort of flip through on the web version. You can either use your right or left arrows, or you've got actually a little arrow to the left or the right that you can click. So you're not really flipping with your hands, but it does feel the same for anybody who's used to the Flipboard experience. And the company says that the full experience, as in your subscriptions, it used to be my Google Reader subscription, some stuff that I've already subscribed to, the whole table of contents that anybody who uses Flipboard for iOS or Android likes will roll out to users by the end of 2013 or maybe even 2014. So right now, if you go to Flipboard.com and you sign in, you see some curated stuff that Flipboard has thrown in there. There's like one thing on road trips and just kind of gives you a sense of how the Flipboard experience will work on the web. Plus, you can access your own curated content, make some changes to your bio and this and that on the web. I don't know, you guys. I played around with the web version of Flipboard for a bit this morning. I like the way it looks. I'm certainly familiar with how it looks. But in a way, there's something strange about this whole curated thing on the web, because all of a sudden, I'm just throwing stuff that maybe I want to read later or bunch in together content-wise. It almost feels like Flipboard's version of Pinterest, where I'm kind of pinning stuff or I'm flipping into a magazine stuff that I'm interested in. What do you guys think? Does this make sense that Flipboard should just be on the web and get better traction?
Yeah, it never made sense to me that they weren't on the web. Honestly, I mean, I just felt like any of these services that limit themselves to tablets have always been limiting themselves. So I wonder, it makes me wonder if Flipboard is starting to bump up on some limits and they realize, oh, well, if we do an HTML5 version, A, that makes it more flexible to port it across to new platforms when they become available. And B, suddenly everybody can use it and we can increase our user space. I just wonder if they weren't starting to see their growth curve flatten out and they realized, oh, you know what the World Wide Web has? A huge worldwide audience.
Yeah, and as more and more devices have touchscreens on it, it just makes sense to have an interface that would make sense with a touchscreen. Almost every Windows 8 laptop at this point, we saw the leap yesterday, so a lot more gesture support than we're used to with laptops and desktops. I think with this idea that you can only have like the kind of read later thing, I do the same thing, Sarah, with my Flipboard, application. The idea that maybe there's a lot more content that's going to be curated by users. And that way, instead of running into that thing where people are using Flipboard as a Google Reader replacement and a device that or an application that can give you all your subscriptions, you have this larger and larger base of people or editors coming up with their own magazines. So now Flipboard can boast, like, we have millions of magazines from our users and you can subscribe to them online.
Yeah, I almost see the future of Flipboard as, sure, it's nice when anybody wants to subscribe to my magazine, but I'm really kind of doing it for myself more than I am doing it to impress somebody who comes and reads my magazine. I mean, I think I have like 30 subscribers. It's not a huge community. However, certain brands, I mean, I know TechCrunch has a Flipboard magazine, for example, Lonely Planet, where they have quite a few subscribers. But I like the idea of having something that is basically just a bunch of bookmarks for myself that I can go back to and read at my leisure, and it looks nice. It's got that Flipboard experience as well. So, and then of course, if you are to click into, let's say I've put together a bunch of recipes in my personally curated Flipboard magazine, if Tom ends up clicking into one of the recipes, he may be dumped back over to the originating site at chow.com with their own ad. So there is an incentive from people and brands to make these Flipboard magazines, because it may end up providing traffic back to your originating site after all.
Last word to you, Nate Langston. You like this new Flipboard for the web?
Yeah, I think it's a good move. I think it's come at an interesting time, what with Google Reader shutting down and sites like Feedly sort of taking over to provide a very similar sort of service. So yeah, it's a good one to watch. And I think because it started out, you know, on iOS, the fact that iOS isn't necessarily the only sort of big tablet platform now, it makes sense for them to kind of migrate and be more platform agnostic.
All right, let's talk about this Nobel Prize-winning economist that has some ideas for the patent system, getting rid of software patents, namely. Gary Becker won the Nobel Prize several years ago. He writes a blog with Judge Posner and wrote recently that, yesterday, I think, they should cut the patent term in half to 10 years, eliminate software and DNA patents and maybe other categories, and take a minimalist approach. Now, as far as patent trolls, he has an interesting perspective. He says, with a well-designed and functioning patent system, this type of intermediary, trolls, would be valuable in the patent market. They're valuable in the housing and the stock market. The problem arises because a defective patent system creates opportunities for holdups and excessive litigation by these intermediaries and by others that hold patents. I thought that was interesting. Imagine if somebody who flips houses, instead of flipping houses and upgrading them, just held them and hoarded them to try to drive up the price and cause problems in the housing market. But here's the part that's getting a lot of attention. Software patents. He says, get rid of them. Here's what he says. Becker says, disputes over software patents are among the most common, expensive, and counterproductive. Their exclusion from the patent system would discourage some software innovations, but the savings from litigation costs over disputed patent rights would more than compensate the economy for that cost. Moreover, some software innovations would be encouraged because the inability to patent software will eliminate uncertainty over whether someone else with a similar patent will sue and do battle in the courts. So, Nate, let's take a look at his let's take his word about the cost and the effect on the economy for now. He's a Nobel Prize winning economist. Should we eliminate software patents even if it loses us some innovation?
There was part of me that kind of hoped I wouldn't have to answer this question. he's a much smarter guy than me to be commenting on software patents. The thing is, from a broad perspective, what I see is that software patents on software provide huge sources of problems for a great deal of people, whether it's consumers, whether it's people making software. And so I'm kind of assuming that these sorts of decisions are probably going the direction that it should go. But that's probably about as far as I can sort of knowledgeably comment without getting myself into hot water, I think.
Fair enough. I know we talk a lot about the patent system and you know what it's meant to do. And I think this is a really interesting criticism because Gary Becker is saying, no, I agree with all the people who say we need a patent system and it needs to do certain things, but it just isn't working well. Then he kind of throws the baby out with the bathwater a little bit with software patents.
Yeah, he says to get rid of them. And then the first thought I have is basically that law school question of like, why stop there? Why not continue, take the argument to the nth degree, eliminate all patents and what happens there? I don't think that's what this fellow is actually advocating at all. But limiting the time seems to make a lot more sense to me. But then again, there's still ways to keep your trade secrets. It's called trade secrets. So you might see more lawsuits there. So you might see a lot more companies being much more secretive when it comes to technologies they are working on. So instead of having the transparency of patents where Apple or Samsung has to actually write out and explain their methodology so that in 20 years people can copy it all they want because it's fully explained, you would have Coca-Cola style trade secrets where you never get to see what happens. Although people could reverse engineer it all they want, it'll never be Coca-Cola, right? That's the same kind of thing. I'm just thinking about back at the iPhone announcement, the original one, with Steve Jobs saying, and boy, have we patented it. The concept is to help the stockholders have security and this idea of, oh, Apple's going to have a lock on this for a while, and that's going to be an advantageous thing. We're going to invest in the company. Just kind of curious how that would shake out, but it's a really intriguing idea.
And to your point about the where do we stop, should we get rid of all patents, he says, essentially, patents should be considered a last resort, not a first resort, to be used only when market-based methods of encouraging innovation are likely to be insufficient. I like that way of thinking about it. Like, yes, we do need patents to protect innovation, but only when nothing else will do it. And the trade secrets thing he does bring up, and that's a really good example, Ayaz, is, you know, you can still protect your methods of doing things in other ways. Maybe you shouldn't be relying on the court system or the government to protect you.
And he suggested things like prizes, like Nobel Prizes for this kind of innovation. Yeah. So that way, instead of you going, investors are paying you, you'll have these big non-profit organizations giving you money. And that might be a good incentive. Like I was saying, it's an intriguing idea. I don't know where I fall on this one way or another.
It works for science. Let's bring it back down to earth a little bit. I've been actually setting up my Ouya upstairs because I finally got it shipped and I finally got around to setting it up. But I haven't had a chance to look at the store yet. Apparently, Everybody's just downloading free stuff.
Yeah, there's a number of reports right now. That's like Edge Online has one, IGN has one, and so does Gamasutra. I never say that right. About how developers are doing and games are doing on the Ouya. Now, Edge Online has numbers from Towerfall. This is the game that was Ouya's flagship launch game. Now, the developer says that they've made about 2,000 sales at $15 a piece. And this fellow's name is Matt Thorson. He says, so sales have been surprisingly high for a new game on a new console. He seemed relatively positive in the Edge Online article. And then from the game NimbleQuest, there were 6,500-plus downloads in the first week, 122 purchases for a profit of $427. NimbleBits' David Marsh said, it was a snap to port it and recommended indie developers continue to make games for the Ouya because it's the only console with a truly open store. Now, Gamasutra had a different take from Ryan Weimer, maker of Oregon Trail. Not Oregon Trail, but Oregon Trail. He says he doesn't know if it was worth the man hours, and adding controller support for Oregon Trail was a pain and the bulk of the port. When asked what's good about Ouya, developers seem generally happy with Ouya's support. Apparently, they're very, very talkative. If you have a problem, you can get technical support. But on the downside, the developers are not exactly having a good time with the controller. A lot of complaints about button stickiness and things like that. Game discovery and marketing is an issue. Nate, does the low revenue ensure that Ouya is flat out going to have a bunch of indie games and we're never going to see somebody like EA on this? And is that even a bad thing?
I think there was one of the big publishers, I think, said they were going to be on Ouya. But I mean, we've seen some really big success stories from, you know, indie developers, you know, games like Torchlight and Minecraft, Super Meat Boy, Limbo, those sorts of games. Like, they're all kind of indie games and they've all done extremely well, but they've all been on platforms that have had a very large existing install base, whether that's Steam on PCs and Mac, whether it's been on, you know, on Xbox or PlayStation. And I think part of the problem here is the fact that it's still a relatively new console. You know, its install base is still quite low, and that has an obvious knock-on effect to how many people are able to buy games. And so I think it's one of these things where it's still a little bit too early to tell, perhaps, as to how long, you know, these sorts of reports will last.
Yeah, I mean, there's still people who haven't got the Ouya that they should have got when they backed it. There's people like me that had shipping issues of all different kinds. Mine was trying to get my address changed with them and get it to come to the right address. Other people have had other shipping issues. So maybe there may not be just that critical mass of people using the Ouya all the time. And we may never see that critical mass, but you've got to give it a chance to get the uptake from a lot of different people before you're really going to see a lot of money pouring in, I think.
I mean, is the number for NimbleQuest right? 6,500 plus downloads in a week, 122 purchases, a profit of $427. And I know.
Yeah, I double checked it. It's right.
Yeah. I mean, the NimbleBits David Marsh says, hey, it was easy to port. Well, that's fine. But it sounds like that's something that they're like, hey, we want to support a truly open store for a console. It's not going to make them any money.
Yeah, so I think the curiosity for me for Ouya is the fact that they want to have exclusive games. But if you're seeing this kind of profit, it seems really low. And some of these developers were saying how it's like a little bit extra. So if they have an iOS game, that'll make them all the money, but supporting Ouya doesn't take that much work because porting it's so easy. So I just don't know if Ouya has a bunch of non-exclusive games, does that really have a draw at all? If you have the same games that are on your Android device on iOS, does it make a difference for these developers to be making these ports at all?
Kind of a chicken and egg problem there, right? You're not going to invest as a big company in making a lot of games for Ouya until you've got critical mass of people using it. People may not start using it until the games come. And the whole idea of doing this long lead-in was to give developers a chance to make great games. And that may be the death knell for Ouya, is not its form factor or its innovativeness. It just may be the fact that they never get the right collection of games and hit on all those points. I hope not, actually. Yeah, I was setting it up this morning. It's a really nice piece of kit, as they say. Go ahead, Nate.
Yeah, I think there's a comparison that could maybe be drawn to how Apple launched the iPad, you know, which was one of their big selling points to begin with was you can play all your iPhone games. You know, every game you bought, every app you bought, you can play on the iPad. It doubles the pixels and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, that, I think, definitely helped convince people to take a chance on the hardware. You know, particularly for something they wouldn't otherwise normally go out and buy. And I think that maybe, you know, if it would have possible for Ouya to do something similar here or to have done so far, maybe that could have made a difference, because I think it's definitely helped others in similar positions in the past.
All right, let's take a quick break and thank our other sponsor for today's show, ShareFile by Citrix. In business, in fact, I had an example of this last week. There was a tax form that my partner needed in the LLC that I run. And I was like, well, okay, I don't want to just send this on the open internet. I mean, ShareFile is the way you can not risk confidential information in some kind of online box or some kind of email or attachment, because there's no guarantee that attachment will go through or get to the right place. That's why we use ShareFile by Citrix. It's the better way to send and receive files of almost any size. With ShareFile, you can easily and securely send everything from large documents to PowerPoints, and the files are sent as a link. You upload it to your secure ShareFile box. The recipient gets a link. It's dead simple. Sometimes they don't even realize it's not an attachment, but you don't get bounce backs. You can track when it was downloaded. You can set access controls so you know only the right people got it. You know it's secure. Plus, ShareFile allows you to store your files on the cloud so you can access them from anywhere. It's just a bonus. You can laptop, mobile device, work on the go. I want you to try ShareFile with our special offer. Sign up today. Receive a 30-day free trial, no obligation. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TNT. Remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in TNT. We thank Citrix and ShareFile for their support of Tech News Today. Been reading a lot of stuff about how companies are scrambling to get instant delivery, same-day delivery, and eBay's got some news in this category, Sarah.
Yeah, so eBay Now is expanding. The San Francisco, San Jose, New York experiments have been successful enough for eBay to say, okay, well, we're going to add service for pretty much the entire Bay Area in the San Francisco area. A couple more boroughs in New York. We got Brooklyn and Queens. Chicago and Dallas will get eBay Now later this summer. eBay Now, of course, is a joint partnership with between eBay and some big partners like the Home Depot or Target or Radio Shack, Best Buy, where you pay a delivery premium at a minimum of, I think, $25, and you get some goods delivered to you within a set amount of time, you know, an hour, that sort of thing. When it first launched, it was kind of like, okay, well, is this more of a, gosh, we've got a meeting and the conference room, we need an HDMI cable, nobody has time, maybe that this is the perfect opportunity for get somebody down at an electronics store. But eBay says that they've seen all sorts of interesting stuff. For example, New York has had a heat wave lately, so they've had a lot of deliveries on air conditioning units, that sort of thing. They've decided also to launch a PC version of eBay Now for the desktop. Previously, it was just apps, mobile devices. And they said, for the most part, people who are accessing eBay are coming from both. So it really just makes no reason. It makes no sense for us to only stick to a mobile environment when we have all these potential customers on the desktop as well. So that's obviously kind of a trend for the day. I guess the idea is that, you know, within an hour is interesting. eBay Now is competing with a variety of services. We've got Google Shopping Express, which is probably eBay's most obvious competitor. But then you've got startups like TaskRabbit, where you hire somebody to go do something for you. Maybe it's to get that HDMI cable or something else. Postmates is a little bit more equated with food. They're all in various markets. Nobody is completely blanketing any sort of a global market or even a national market. Although eBay Now says later this summer, they're going to introduce a new capability. So it's not just within an hour, you can choose your own delivery window. So it's a little bit more of, hey, I'm a working professional. I need this stuff. I want it delivered to me between 5 and 6. Guys, when I read all of this, I've had a hard time since eBay Now rolled out to equate eBay with a delivery service. I still feel like eBay has a little bit of a interesting marketing issue, how they start to equate themselves with this sort of thing and not that kind of auction site, legacy auction site. This seems like this is just eBay struggling to get into a market that Amazon's going to dominate when Amazon finally figures out how to offer not just same day delivery, but, you know, within a certain time frame delivery to a huge audience that Amazon already has. Am I wrong? Nate, what do you think?
It's funny that you mentioned TaskRabbit, because in my notes ahead of the show, TaskRabbit was my first one. And I thought that is a really interesting model for eBay to be moving into, because they've I would argue that the eBay name is far more recognizable than TaskRabbit currently, outside of, you know, people who use those sorts of services a lot. But I think that you mentioned the postage, and I still think that this is a real issue with eBay, because when you buy from Amazon Marketplace, that the postage prices tend to be fixed, either based on weight or country or region, things like that. And, you know, that gives me a lot more confidence as a shopper buying from, you know, a private individual, that I'm not getting, you know, ripped off on the postage. And I kind of think that eBay does need to sort out that postage system, that delivery system. And if this maybe combined with a TaskRabbit kind of, you know, personal delivery sort of thing is a step towards fixing that problem, I think that could end up being very interesting. And I speak as someone who's used eBay for the first time in about 5 years this week. So they're doing something interesting.
I dream of the day when I can actually just go online, see what products are available nearby, decide whether I want to drive there or pick a delivery, and how fast I want it delivered and how much I want to pay for that delivery, and then just move on, you know, just the most convenient way to do the things that I want to do. So this is a tiny step in that direction, obviously, but I love this kind of stuff.
Well, hold on, Tom. What you're describing is something that is already possible. You're just saying do you want to see it?
No,
all?
It's
you
not.
Know, some sort of a
you
nice
can't
graph
find
on a single
every
page?
Store around you. You can't just say, like, okay, of all the stores within 5 miles of me, which one has this product? You can't do that yet. It's all cobbled together. So yeah, I'm talking about the dream idea of comprehensiveness. It's getting closer, though. You're absolutely right. Let's talk about Google. Still always, you know, they make their money on ads, trying to shove some more ads in your face.
Yeah, there's a new style of ad that's showing up in Gmail, and it's either annoying people or they don't seem as obtrusive at all. Now, this appears if you're using the new Gmail where you have several tabs, so you get primary, social, and promotions. Now, in the promotions tab, you'll see ads in the same column you would see in the email. It's not that little ticker on the top. The ads are offset from the rest of your email as they are colored with a light yellow and have the word ad appearing under what looks like the sender's name, but you haven't been signed up for new emails. These are not emails. These are simply ads that are placed in that same column. It's not like Google's giving out your information. Google says you'll only see sponsored links in the promotions tab and no more ticker on the top, so you don't have to keep dealing with that every single time you go to email.
Mm-hmm.
Nate, from what I've seen online, people think this is horrible. Some people think it's great. They don't. It seems like it's all over the place in reactions. Where do you stand on the new approach when it comes to Google ads?
Well, of course, people don't like change. You know, like if you change something, you're going to get riots in the street virtually. But, you know, I kind of like this. You know, I mean, I look at Facebook as a good example of where ads can be bad. And, you know, every day I see an ad on Facebook and I would almost at this point pay money to not have certain ads shown to me because they annoy me so much, either because I feel like I've been stereotyped and that ad has been targeted at me and yet it's still wrong. And so I think that the goal here is for Google to just get ads correct. And I think as long as the ads are correct, they're no more intrusive than Facebook or Twitter's inline sponsored tweets. And I don't honestly think that's going to be a major problem in the long run. And if they're confined within a tab, then they're easy for people to ignore anyway.
Yeah, I can't tell what I think
about this already.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
We were talking about this all yesterday. It's like it's easy as long as it's clearly marked, whether it's color coded or otherwise, to sort of train your eye to say that's an ad. I can pay attention to it if I want to, and I can kind of, you know, it's just part of my peripheral vision. If I don't, at least it is for me. I cannot tell you over the last year any ad that's ever shown up for me in Gmail so far. Yes, this might be a little bit more intrusive, but I have no doubt that I'll just stop looking at those too.
Yeah, it's funny when you say, like, I can't remember a Gmail ad. The only ones that I can even remember noticing, and I can't tell you what they were ones that made me laugh because I'm like, oh, that's because I'm looking at this email and it's totally unrelated, but it's funny. So, yeah, taking it out of the top and putting it in promotions. I'm glad it's out of the top. It's probably not going to bother me because in that promotions tab, pretty much what I do is go in and go check all, delete, buy. So I don't know that I'm going to be spending any more time looking at the ads. It is unsettling to think of them putting them closer into your inbox, though. I'm a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I already have the blindness towards that ticker on top anyway. I just put the tabs back to see what it would be like if the ads were in there. It's already set with a bunch of ads. I've got, you know, emails from ThinkGeek and let's see, the Hyatt and 1-800-PetMeds. So I'm already obviously in the mindset of buying stuff if I'm going to promotions. I think it's actually a really smart idea for Google to move it there. If you're not seeing it in your primary email, because I know sometimes I'll be talking about like food in a primary email, and then you'll see an ad for recipes or something. And it's somewhat useful, but not exactly what you want as an ad. But if you're in your promotion section, and if Google is actually taking note of what you're clicking on and what you're clicking through to, they'll have a better idea of what kind of ads you want to see. Because if you're clicking promotions, you probably want to see, and maybe you're willing to part with money. And that's actually a good idea for Google, because it's not so – I don't think it's so intrusive – any more so than Google already reading my email and seeing, oh, you like to buy this kind of stuff, you like that kind of stuff.
Although when you bundle too many things together,
high-end business hotels, got it. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
When you bundle too many things together and call it promotions, then that's just sort of a spam tab that I'm gonna stop looking at, and that sucks if any email ends up getting through the algorithm somehow and ends up under the promotions tab. I've actually turned off that whole promotions social thing because I feel like somehow I'm missing things and things are sometimes routed to the wrong places. And I just don't like Gmail doing that for me. So I don't know. I mean, if it turns into just a bunch of like, oh, the promotions place is where advertisements go that I never want to look at, I don't know who really wins there.
However, the other side to that too is that you have some control over that as well, right? Like you can go in and right-click on a message that ends up in the wrong inbox and assign it to another one. So you just really have to notice that ended up in the wrong one once and then route it.
Yeah.
But still, it's kind of a pain. I totally agree.
All right, let's finish up with a story that's actually been getting a lot of votes on our subreddit about cnetsdownload.com. A lot of comments. We don't get that many comments on the submissions on our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. But this one's had more than 40 comments last time I looked, probably more now. They're complaining about CNET bundling in programs with the stuff that you download from them. Complaints have been going on about download.com since pretty much download.com launched, even before they were part of CNET. But they keep recurring. The most recent ones, back in August, Extreme Tech warned developers that all updates software would be wrapped in Tech Tracker software unless you paid extra. You had to pay for a premium level to submit. You had to pay anyway to submit your software to download, but you had to pay a premium level, which is like $79 versus $99 for the year, to exempt your software from the Tech Tracker software. That Tech Tracker software is installation software that is downloaded to your desktop and then downloads and installs stuff. It's a way for them to push ads at you. In November, Download had to apologize for wrapping open source software like Nmap and VLC with toolbar installers. That was a big controversy for them. And Groovy Post is the link out of our subreddit showing the confusing process to install without, if you don't want to get things like Delta Toolbar or Sweet Packs, you really have to pay attention. They'll put the terms of service up with an accept button, but the accept button refers to installing something like Delta Toolbar. You have to actually decline and then accept the terms of service on the next page. It's very confusing. So you might look into something like Nynite.com that installs for you and says no to all toolbars and extra software. And it's certainly not a new thing. I've got a link in here all the way back to 2005 of people getting upset that a Trojan or spyware seemed to be getting installed along with download software. Nate, you and I both used to work for CNET. We kind of know some of the internal arguments and the internal fights that always go on to stop these sort of ultra monetization of this sort of thing. Should anybody use these kind of download aggregator sites at this point anyway? Shouldn't you just get your software direct from the company?
Well, there are two answers. I mean, one thing is that, you know, these sorts of sites do massive traffic, huge traffic. So it's hugely valuable. And I think from a business perspective, anything that's doing very, very well, you're going to think, how can it do better? So I kind of understand it from a business perspective. But I think the knock-on effect with something like this is
is bad for download, these sorts of download sites on the whole, you know, whether it's download.com or Softpedia, because I think what it's actually doing is forcing people to consider using closed off app stores a lot more, because they can give trust to the people who create those stores, whether it's the app store for on OS X, whether it's, you know, Windows Marketplace, things like that. There's some level of security that comes with only getting your apps from those places. And I think that once people start moving towards app stores and these gated communities, purely because that's the only thing they feel like they can trust, it damages people who don't want to put their software on app stores because they want to keep some sort of control for financial reasons or whatever. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. And so, you know, it's hard to know exactly on which side to fall on this, because there's plus and minus points, but it's also not new. You know, as you said, this has been going on for a long, long time. And actually, I think Leo on MacBreak Weekly last week did a really good walkthrough of how tricky these, you know, installers can be. But they're not new installers. You know, it's been like this for a long time. And I don't know. Maybe app stores are going to force them out of business.
Yeah, they seem to get trickier.
I remember when going to something like download.com was like, I mean, even if you just typed in whatever you were looking for, it was often the first result. And you think, oh, yeah, that's great. I mean, it's basically the same thing as trying to figure out what the URL for the company is. Maybe it was, you know, somewhat obscure at times. But those days are over. I think the last time I tried to just download a small little application, it was the same thing where it was like, oh, wait a second. No. This is actually an ad. Okay, now where's the application? Where's the download now for Mac OS? And I mean, it took me a while.
Yeah, that's worse.
And it's like, who needs it? I think, yeah, in this day and age, we're so used to standalone apps. And I know on the desktop, it's a little bit of a different environment, or on your laptop, but it's gone are the days where anybody should be tricked into downloading a bunch of bloatware that's just junk. So, yeah, I don't see a reason to. If I go to download.com, it is an act of desperation.
Yeah, those sites, like you're saying, Sarah, it's like you have to basically find a needle in a haystack, because every ad says download. You don't know which one is to which. You see the slight gray outline that says ad, and maybe you don't click it by accident. And there's like, it'll time out or some weird thing. There's all kinds of horrible tricks you can get caught into. I guess I'm kind of a bit jaded, though, because anytime I download anything and I see that it's from one of these sources like Softpedia or something, I will have to wait and go, okay, wait, what does that say on the top? Is this saying ask toolbar? That's not what I would try to install. Is it saying this? I'm just trying to download a codec pack. And sometimes those are hard to find. So I don't think anything will change other than Nate's point. App stores get more and more trusted at that point.
And people in the chat room are pointing out that one of the problems is that it's not you, the tech-savvy user, who knows how to avoid this stuff. It's the folks who aren't as familiar with things. And they think, oh, that's a trusted source there that I'm going to see at download.com. And they aren't savvy enough to realize that they're accepting installing a toolbar or some other spyware when they think they're just getting a media player. Go ahead, Nate.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting changes that I've seen over the last few years is that these sorts of sites used to hotlink installers. So, you know, download.com and similar sites, I'm sure used to, you know, you would click on a link and it would say 404 because the, you know, the person who submitted that, you know, .exe file had moved it to a different location. And now it seems to be centralized. And so they have to go through a controlled filter where this sort of stuff can get applied. And I think that caused a tangible shift in how these sites are run. They become less about search engines and databases and become more about pure forcing stuff onto your computer to make money. And I think that's a bad thing.
All right. Now, mere minutes since we first launched it, it's time to launch the randomizer.
It's truly random, Tom. You never know when it's going to play.
No, exactly, right? Yeah, it could come up anytime. We did a straw poll again for the folks watching live in the chat room between spare Android power being used to power scientific experiments like SETI at home for your Android phone and robotic skin lighting up when touched. And man, it was close. It was neck and neck, right down to the wire, but robotic skin ended up winning. So if you want to find out about the Android thing, we'll leave the link in the show notes. But check out this robotic skin. Now, the scientists are saying things like, well, this could be used for prosthetic limbs or from making, you know, some kind of pressure sensor that could be used in smart wallpapers. But I just want to have glowing skin that, like, you know, when you punch me on the arm, it just glows.
I want mood skin too, so people be like, oh, you're glowing green today, so you're hulking out. Okay, just we'll step away now, or whatever, green for go. I don't know what they would do, but yeah, I'm with you.
Or you could become like your own personal download site and just have advertisements.
Oh, it could be like the Dazzler from X-Men. Yeah, I'm gonna have to be a rock star singing person.
Remember when Chris Perillo was selling his Rent My Chest? This would have been great for him. He could have had so many more messages if he'd had glowing skin.
Well, maybe that could be a source of revenue for us, guys.
On our foreheads. I mean, throughout the show, we each have our own sponsor imprinted into our skin.
Forehead is obviously the most valuable. Mm-hmm. That'd be the highest CPM. But you could have hands, like every once in a while, just like, oh, well, raise your hand and then you'd see a little logo.
Well, you make an emphatic point. Yeah. And that's what I think about eBay now.
It's an emoticon.
Perhaps our emphatic point package is right for you. All right, let's see what's on the calendar.
Well, Apple and AT&T earnings reports are both later today. Tomorrow, it's Facebook's turn. So lots of earnings coming out this week. Also tomorrow is 500 Startups Demo Day West. That is taking place in Mountain View, California.
Excellente. What's incoming?
Incoming message.
It's a message from Los Angeles. OC Alexander writes in to say, charging customers to upgrade to iOS 7 apps might hurt iPhone and iPad sales. Among many reasons some users stick with the iPhone or iPad is because they have a significant dollar investment in iOS apps. Apple risks letting Google and other competitors peel away customers if many developers try to charge customers to pay all over again to get the iOS 7 version of apps they already own. If a user is going to have to pay for an app anyway, he or she might see this as an opportunity to jump to an Android or Windows phone or to buy a shiny new Nexus 7 tablet instead of waiting for the next release of the iPad or iPad Mini. And this issue may also influence the purchase decisions of owners of older versions of iOS devices that won't be able to run iOS 7. The total buy-in cost of hardware and apps might make a new Android or Windows purchase a better overall value and still give the customer a good overall user experience. Great show and thought-provoking news stories. Keep the good work. It's a really good point about iOS 7. Theoretically, you might have to buy apps that you already own.
Yeah, well, this story smacks to me of a little bit of overhype. We'll see how many companies actually do make you pay all over again.
Well,
he's right.
I mean,
a lot of them did. That could be the effect.
Yeah, I mean, it is a practice that's already happening. It'll just be interesting to see how many companies say, well, I had to do it because of iOS 7 anyway. Got another email from Jonathan Stark who says, regarding your lukewarm response to the Leap Motion Controller yesterday, episode 800, I agree it's kind of gimmicky when used to interact with a laptop. But I think focusing on laptops is a little nearsighted. I have two smartwatches, and the input options on both of them stink. One has a touchscreen, which is too small to be useful. The other has hardware buttons, which is too limiting for developers. If it was small enough, Leap could be the perfect input method for a smartwatch. Your finger wouldn't block the content. App developers would be able to create novel and expressive interactions. Plus, we don't have 30 years of mouse-based software baggage on watches. Assuming that they catch on, we're all going to have to learn how to interact with and program for smartwatches. Leap-style touchless gestures seems perfectly suited for this particular form factor.
That is intriguing. I played a lot more with the Leap yesterday, and it got easier to use. There is a learning curve to it. And I installed touchless and I was able to control my desktop and everything. But it's still, every once in a while, it's just wonky. Like, I can't quite, maybe it's just learning curve, but I haven't quite mastered how to easily click on things. It's this long process of like, okay, am I zooming in? Am I in the touch area? Yeah, okay. It moved because your elbow moves. And it's so some of that may go away, but I can't imagine trying to do that on a watch the way it is now. That would be even more annoying.
I bet Samsung could pull it off. They have all those funky features in the S4. Why not bring it to a phone? If you have like eye tracking or the gesture based stuff, it could probably fit there.
Yeah.
Even if you don't use it.
The Leap, you know, the thing the Leap actually reminded me of was in 1994, I had a voice control app that came with my Sound Blaster audio card that allowed me to navigate Windows 3.1 menus with my voice.
Which you still use to this day. Right?
No, it was gimmicky. It worked, but it was gimmicky. And that's how Leap feels right now. As it improves, though, the sensor is there. So maybe the software can get more refined. Maybe it'll feel less gimmicky over time. And obviously, voice control is totally normal now. for lots of things. Thank you all for writing in, TNT at twit.tv. Nate Langston, sorry about the lag issue with the internet today, but always great having you in. Great points, great talking with you. What's going on over at wired.co.uk?
Yeah, thank you for bearing with my connection. It's very much my issue here. Apparently 4G, Wi-Fi, and Ethernet, all bad ways of connecting to Skype from this office this evening. Wow. So thank you for putting up with my quality. What's going on with Wired.co.uk? Well, I mean, I tend to... we're putting a lot of focus on our podcast at the moment, which is the Wired UK podcast. It's doing really, really well. So it's still my baby somewhat. So if anyone's interested in hearing what I sound like, not through a dodgy, 2 kilobit connection, then do check out the Wired UK podcast. We do that every week from here on a Thursday. It's in iTunes. And the other thing that I wanted to point out is that this morning I got to use Google Glass for the first time, and I've done a write-up about my experience.
Nice.
It was surreal. They've just introduced a web browser, so apparently that wasn't there a week ago. So I got to try out using a web browser on Google Glass, which is was pretty fiddly, but quite interesting. I'm a fan of the tech in general, so yeah, that's today anyway.
Yeah, it is a weird thing, as Jason knows very well. It you kind of want it to keep going in the direction it's going, but it's certainly not there yet. All right, that is it for us. You can find our subreddit, as we mentioned earlier, technewstoday.reddit.com. Get in there and submit some votes, make some comments, vote some things up and down. We appreciate all the feedback we get there. Helps us create our lineup each and every day. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. Links to all our show notes and all that good stuff. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv, and give us a call. Leave us a voicemail if you like. Our number is 260-TNT-SHOW. We continue our British theme with Will Harris tomorrow. See you then.